Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. One of our guests today led the Florida Seminole Tribe during its challenge before the U.S. Supreme Court over gaming on tribal lands. It was a legal victory that's helped kickstart a casino and gambling industry on Native American lands, now estimated to be worth more than $33 billion. Former Seminole Chief James Billy now wants to do for marijuana what the tribes achieved for gaming, aiming to make tribal producers the source for marijuana in a growing number of states that have legalized recreational and medical use of the drug. Billy's partnering with Nevada-based Electrum Partners in an effort to bring investment and expertise to marijuana growing operations on Native American lands. Jim Billy, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
Despite the shifting legal sands of cannabis use at the state level, the drug remains illegal at the federal level with a Schedule I classification that declares the drug to have, quote, no currently accepted medical use and, quote, a high potential for abuse. Other Schedule I drugs include heroin and LSD. Also joining us today to talk about how they're planning to grow a business on some tenuous legal footing is Leslie Boxcore. He's the president of Electrum Partners. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you so much for having us on the air.
I appreciate you being here. We're talking about the legal marijuana industry with former Florida Seminole Chief Jim Billy and a plan to bring marijuana crops to tribal lands across the country. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, a former Seminole Chief Jim Billy, I want to start with a little background about your experience leading the Seminole Tribe of Florida during a fight to have gaming, bingo, and other forms of gambling on tribal lands. Take us back to 1979 when you came to lead that tribe.
1979, I think it was about June 10th, I became chairman of the Seminole Tribe. And it seemed like within an hour after I got inaugurated, I was introduced to a package that had bingo on it. And I was a little reluctant to try anything like that because in this 25 CFR, there's all kind of rules and regulation that says that there's no gaming on the reservations. But when I looked further into it, and when the people that was helping me out on it, or introduced the bingo to me, said, this can happen, and if it's legal in the state of Florida, it is civil and regulated. It's not criminal and prohibitory. It could happen. So with a little reluctancy, I called up to Washington, D.C. There's a bunch of consultants up there. I wrote a letter to them and asked them if this could happen. Well, they wrote me a letter like lawyers do. They went down the middle of the road and they said, no, it's a gray area and it cannot happen. So when they said gray area, that kind of opened up the door for me. I went ahead and challenged it. And luckily, the people that was investing in us to do this said that if you want to challenge it, we will provide the funding, the expertise, the management and the know-how, and we'll fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. All you got to do is get on this wild horse and hang on. So I did, and the rest of it is history. So it was because in the state of Florida, we Seminoles have sovereign land, and it could happen. So they did provide the expertise, and it was legal. And they were having bingo in the state of Florida, so it was legal and civil and regulated. So the rest of it is history. So this marijuana is almost the same, except that Florida doesn't have the whole legalities in place yet. So our focus is not Florida right now. Later on it might be, but on the different legalities, I would let Leslie talk about that.
Yeah, so this is kind of a similar story, a different product, different There are a lot of things that are different about it, but then there is a lot of similarity, again, like you mentioned. So, Leslie Boxcore with Electrum Partners, I want to get you in on the conversation now. So, tell me about your company and why you've entered into this partnership.
So, Electrum Partners is an advisory firm and essentially a holding company with multiple assets in the industry that we maintain. We advise businesses on how to navigate the legal marijuana industry, the legal cannabis industry. We advise jurisdictions like the state of Pennsylvania, the state of Nevada, on their regulatory frameworks. We have stakeholders in other countries like Costa Rica, Spain, Mexico, Germany, that we've also been in touch with, as well as stakeholders from other jurisdictions in the United States, both on a state and local basis, that we advise as it regards the establishment and implementation of an effective regulatory framework for legal cannabis here in the United States and beyond. We advise businesses in all sorts of different aspects of the legal cannabis industry, adult use, medical marijuana, pharmaceuticals based on cannabis, nutraceuticals and supplements based on cannabis, the industrial hemp industry, veterinary applications, and animal agriculture applications, both for small and large animals, and the ancillary industry.
So what
those break out into others as well.
So what kind of opportunity do you see for Native Americans when it comes to legalized cannabis?
I see a massive opportunity. So first, what we see is, In a situation where there are so many different regulatory frameworks in place, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Montana, and the list goes on throughout the country, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, et cetera, we now see the Native American community able to, one, provide access to people in those jurisdictions for the industry, so they can set up regulated businesses that cultivate, that manufacture, that are going to be retail and distributors for that category in their jurisdictions, whether it's New York or Connecticut or Nevada. There's an opportunity for the Native American tribes in those jurisdictions to get into the business. And that is very important because many of these jurisdictions have limited licensing environments. And that means, for example, in New York, there's only 5 licenses. In Connecticut, I think there's 2 or 3. Rhode Island, 2 or 3. Nevada, there are 60-plus dispensaries, 100 cultivation, 100 extraction facilities, manufacturing facilities. And so the Native Americans can get into that business and start providing something, a partnership with another or existing purveyor in the industry, and they can choose the best of the best to get into it, one, and participate in the industry where there's limited licensing. And then two, and perhaps more important, is because of the federal status of cannabis, there's the implementation of something called Internal Revenue Code 280E that is essentially unfairly taxing legal cannabis businesses throughout the country. I was just speaking to an operator in Maine who said their effective tax rate was essentially 85%. Typically, between 60 and 85% is the effective tax rate that legal cannabis businesses deal with as a result of Internal Revenue Code 280E. Native Americans are not subject to federal tax for Native American-owned businesses, and as such, they'd have a competitive advantage of between 60 and 85% margin right off the bat in being able to compete versus non-Native American-owned businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I get what you're saying, but I wanted to ask Jim Billy, tell me how you and presumably your lawyers are going to be reading this idea of tribal sovereignty when it comes to marijuana cultivation. How does that work out?
Well, you're talking to that lawyer now, as Leslie. And he's the one that's why you're talking to him straight from the mouth.
And so, what I'll say to that is, one, I'm not an attorney, although I specialize in this, and we have attorneys that we work with. And so, what I'll say as regards sovereignty is, if there is a concern, because there have been a couple of attempts to do this that have not gone well, the Santee Sioux, I believe, in South Dakota, there was a tribe in California that was not able to execute effectively. And let's talk about the Santee Sioux in South Dakota. South Dakota does not have a regulated framework for cannabis, and so we think they were off to a bad start to begin with, and the operators that they worked with also did not build the proper consensus amongst policymakers prior to doing it. The same thing happened in California. California only established regulations that passed in 2015 are now being implemented in 2018. And so anything that got done prior to there being a regulated market was going to have a challenge to begin with.
Okay,
and the way we like to think about it is this, that sort of can clarify the issue. Let's use Nevada, for example. In Nevada, there are, as I said, 100 cultivation licenses, 100 manufacturing licenses, and 60-plus dispensary licenses. The Las Vegas Paiute, for example, if they were to attempt to cultivate, manufacture, and set retail up on their reservation here in the city of Las Vegas, and the federal government were to say, well, we don't approve of that, which they don't really have the right to approve or not approve of it, the tribe could easily just buy one of the licenses that exists that the state's already granted. So now what's the difference then between the tribe buying a license that's already been granted by the state and is operational in the state versus setting up their own operation on their land? What's the real difference there? The sovereignty, in my understanding, determines that they should be able to operate it on their land or off their land if they own it, either way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see this as a sort of a very slippery slope for the federal government to go down, because it would, if they were to discriminate against a Native American-owned business because it's Native American-owned, that would probably be a bad choice considering the various acts of that have established sovereignty for Native Americans.
Okay, so we're in Florida, okay? They have passed medical marijuana. Then there is Native American land here in Florida. What can they do on that land? Can they grow it, for example, and sell it to someone in a different state? Can they grow it and then sell it to someone to refine it that has a license to do that kind of manufacturing?
Let's try to look at this in a couple of different ways. First, let's say under the guidance given by the Cole memo and the Wilkinson memo issued by the Department of Justice, various Cole memos, the Ogden memo, and then the Wilkinson memo between the years of 2010 and 2014. I think the Wilkinson memo was the end of 2014, if I'm not mistaken. Those memos were there to respond to state-regulated cannabis while it remains federally illegal. And it gave guidance to the U.S. attorneys about how they could approach this. And there were various enforcement priorities that were created, such as keeping it out of the hands of minors, not allowing for diversion, making sure you're operating within a regulated framework, making sure that you're a good actor within that regulated framework, that there was the appropriate transparency and compliance in place. So that then was applied to Indian country, in quotes, as it falls in the various acts and descriptions by the federal government, that Wilkinson, Deputy Attorney General Wilkinson, established that Native Americans could pursue the same path that is the state's rights path under their sovereignty to cultivate, manufacture, and distribute. Now, as regards could they sell over state lines? Well, under the sovereignty as we understand it granted to Native Americans, they should be able to. Are we going to look to pursue that? I would advise against it. What we're going to look to pursue is in every area where Chief Billy brings us to a Native American tribe that would like to get into the business, we're going to be suggesting that, one, it only take place in states that have established very robust regulatory frameworks like Nevada, Colorado, and such.
Mm-hmm.
Two, we're going to suggest that the tribe do a deep dive review of those regulations and then go through a process of establishing its own regulatory framework to implement for its business that it's going to own. Three, we're going to suggest they go through a very robust vetting process, which we will help them with in determining who the right partner will be for that license that will be granted, assuming they find the right partner and then grant the license, just like the state would do.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be recommending that those regulations will exceed the state requirements. So they will not be looked at as only a good actor, they will be looked at as a best actor in any regulated environment. And then, could they cultivate it on their land? Certainly. Can they manufacture on their land? Certainly. Can they retail it on their land? Certainly. Could they sell it to other providers in the state regulated market? Well, I don't see why not. Could they manufacture that could then get distributed to other providers in the state? Well, I don't see why not. Now, would you know, are we going to look to go in and do these things very aggressively? No, we're going to look to, as I said, be the best actor in every circumstance, build consensus among all the policymakers, meet with the U.S. attorney, meet with the state regulators, meet with the county and local jurisdictions to make sure everybody's on the same page, and then we're going to take it in a step-by-step process.
So,
first, we'll start with cultivation, and then we'll move on from there.
So, Jim Billy, what are you hearing from tribes about getting into the cannabis business?
I have not heard nothing. I have not approached them. The tribe is very conservative. I mean, they're open to probably trying it, but I have not approached the tribe itself. When I was chairman, I did not entertain it, even though people were coming up and saying that they know how to grow it. These were illegitimate people coming up, so I'm not sure what the tribe thinks. I have not even conferred with them. I'm not a tribal chairman anymore. When they had an opportunity, they should have talked to him. But since I'm not chairman anymore, I'm going into this as a private business.
Oh, okay. So you're going into this as a private thing. But I mean, what do you think they're going to do as far as the tribes? I mean, were they conservative when it came to gaming being legalized?
No, I don't think they might not even try anything for a while because they got their own Hard Rock internationally and around here. I don't know if they will even try to step into it to jeopardize their situation there. And that was the main reason why I never really got into it. But then when I became a private citizen, I seen an opportunity for myself to help other tribes around the United States. But I will approach them later or feel the air and see what they feel like. But they were probably the last people I will come to because it's not totally legal here in the state
of
Florida.
Yeah, that's in Florida. But Jim, have you talked to? I'm sorry, Jim. Did you talk to any tribes in other states?
Yes, they are calling up looking for information. See how we can help.
Okay, so outside of Florida, you're having a positive response.
Yeah, just like Leslie said, there's only reservations that are legal in just a few states.
Yeah, it's just
these
a few
are
places.
The people that are calling. Not everybody's calling us. Just a targeted places that is calling us now.
Like Leslie mentioned, the ones that already have clear-cut rules in place. So, Leslie,
Some tribes try to go into it thinking that they got total legal sovereign, and no, they don't. They have to be very careful. It's a very specific area in sovereignty, and this is where Leslie and or MCW comes in. And the electorate comes in to give the advice.
Yeah, to have that kind of legal navigation, because these are new, uncharted waters to try to find your way through. So, Leslie Boxcore with Electrum Partners, you've been quoted as saying that you're looking to invest anywhere from $25 million to $300 million in the next 3 years on this project. So you're going to probably start, I would imagine, in these states where they already have clear-cut rules and regulations?
Absolutely correct. And we have been contacted by tribes in Arizona, California, Washington, Oregon. I believe we got contacted by one from Colorado, Michigan. There have been a number that have already reached out to us.
And so, but mainly you're working with the states that already have things pretty much well hammered out as far as their state legislation. But the people that are in the states that don't have that yet, I mean, obviously you now have that contact, and that'll be something you'll pursue once the states get their rules in place.
Absolutely correct. We're not going to go to any state that has not established a very robust regulatory framework that has been implemented. We will work during the process of implementation, and we will wait until it has been implemented and has an actual operating market, and then we will look at it.
Leslie, do you anticipate there's going to be a time when the federal legal status has changed, and how would that possible eventuality impact this industry?
We do anticipate that federal prohibition will drop in the next 5 to 7 years. And we anticipate that when federal prohibition drops, and that will remove the Internal Revenue Code 280E component, which is a significant, you know, penalty that many of these businesses are currently undergoing, as I said, effective tax rates of 85% on a federal basis. When it gets reduced to a normal federal tax rate, that will once again give the Native American-owned businesses an edge where they do not have to pay that federal tax. And so at that time, I would anticipate that it's entirely possible that the Native American cannabis industry could compete with the industry outside of Native American-owned businesses in the United States. So if we're looking at up to a $20 billion a year industry, that would be in the next 5 or 6 years, that would be non-tribally owned. I would imagine we could see $10 to $20 billion a year in business that would be tribally owned as well, competing with the industry that's non-tribally owned on the national basis.
And that would be
and we once federal prohibition drops.
And that would be a lot of tax dollars. So businesses need access to capital and banking services. Have you seen any struggles that tribes or anyone else privately has had as early investors that they're facing in this area?
Absolutely. There has been a tremendous restriction on the velocity of capital as regards formation for new businesses. The reason for that is the federal illegality keeps many banks from, even though there is a specific path for banking, as clarified by the FinCEN memo of February 14, 2014, that allows for banks to accept deposits from legal cannabis businesses in a completely regulated and compliant way. Even though that's the case, there's still under 400 banks nationally that are currently working with legal cannabis businesses. And as a result, there are none that are offering mortgages and lease finance and things like that on equipment and real estate. So you've just cut out, and then, of course, none of the institutions, because of the federal illegality, are looking at it. None of the traditional institutional lenders, investors. So you've cut out, you know, this huge portion of capital that would normally be funding the growth of the industry. And as a result, finding capital is primarily coming from family offices and ultra-high net worth individual investors.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting partnership that you've struck up with Jim Billy to work with Native American tribes. Do you anticipate that growing into additional states?
Absolutely. Well, what we're looking at with MCW, Chief Billy's business, we're looking to establish these footholds in any state that has a well-regulated market and a federally recognized tribe that has expressed an interest in approaching the industry. There's a tremendous amount of capital out there that is specifically interested in investing in those businesses, and we are being patient and taking our time to make sure we get the right financial partners and the right operating partners so that we can rise to the level that we would expect Chief Billy would demand and expect in any of the partner businesses for his business, MCW.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I do want to thank our guest, Leslie Boxcore with the Electrum Partners, and also former Seminole Chief Jim Billy. Thank you both so much for talking with us today.
Okay. Yeah, sure, Navish.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.